Center.
As long as I keep on this topic, you can hear my limousine in the background there. Yeah, and Sannyasi is just absolutely fabulous. Fabulous. She's 5 foot, 2-3 inches tall, 105 pounds. Hasn't had plastic surgery anywhere. 35, 40 years old now. Good God, I forgot her birthday. And still looks 25. Smart as a whip. Handles that spaceship. I just can't wait to have a... I always told her, can we buzz the highway patrol on the L.A. freeways and have a little spaceship chase for Los Angeles? That would be so cool. It's not going to happen. Oh, well. I tried to get her to eat a hamburger once, but now I'm a vegetarian, so that didn't work. So anyhow, I guess you guessed. Who else would be this idiot in the middle of the night? Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. April 22nd. God, taxes are paid. Boy, I had to sweat that one out. I think I was in a high earning bracket. No, just a high tax bracket. You know, as soon as you get past a small amount, it's a high tax bracket. It's all your money. You should be going back into Paradigm Research. I mean, the amount of money that I pay the government. Oh, I used to be a tax protester. I went through that whole thing, but the only way you change the system is be part of it. And I love the system. I love our president. He is such a perfect example of the consciousness of America, isn't he? I mean, my God. Until somebody steps forward, you got the perfect figurehead for where it's at. Maybe someday somebody will step out in the aisles of Congress or the halls of the Senate and make a difference like they used to 100 years ago when they had clean air and good breathing and more clean air and water that wasn't 20 or 22% radioactive and oxygen content, you know, higher than it is today. And carbon dioxide levels lower than they are today. And not lots of drugs out there. I mean, my God, here we go. Let's see. Let's position ourselves. Here we are. It's 1881. We're in the halls of Congress. And, you know, we got to get this Revolutionary War going here. And so what happens? Well, they're in the Continental Congress in Boston, but is anybody signing anything? No. My great-great-grandfather, Ethan Allen, he's up there in the Lexington-Concord Bridge. Is anybody shooting anything? No. So all of a sudden, in this closed-off Congress hall, this figure appeared. And he said, "Sign that document," meaning the Declaration of Independence. And Mr. Insurance Company, John Hancock, put his John Hancock on it. A moment later, the shot that was heard around the world, fired by Colonel Parker, boom, where I started, end of story. Parker and Ethan Allen went on up to get Fort Ticonderoga, and Washington walked out of Valley Forge. Yes, the rest is history. What happened to those kind of days? You know, why can't we have that kind of energy now? Because we are so polluted. We have so much dropped our energy. It's so sad. And that's what we've allowed ourselves to become. There's nothing I can do about it. I just do my little part here on the bbsradio.com radio show. And that's all I can do. Of course, maybe secretly behind the scenes, I'm building these cool machines that will change consciousness around the world. And that, ladies and gentlemen, I guarantee you is happening. Yeah, everybody's all primed up to get right into the ARV, the Alien Reverse Engineering Vehicle. And that's where I had described the other night. I was telling you about the pilots, and we're just about to get into how it worked. But I decided to change the subject. and go back to our original subject, and that is time travel and space travel, and not go into the mechanics of everything, how it works. We might get back to that in a little bit, but anyhow. In my book, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light, on page 380, I talk about quantum numbers and relationships. Quantum numbers, and you hear the word quantum, you say, oh my God, Albert Einstein. Dr. Edward Teller, hydrogen bomb, you know, on and on and on. Forget it. It only means wave, okay? Wave numbers. Like, you know, when you listen to a wave file, like when I do this radio show, it becomes a wave file. And when you get your little iPod out, it's a wave file. It's just a wave number to lighten up. And then we call it a magnetic wave number. And what we do is, remember, last week you talked about oxygen. And oxygen, it's such a great molecule. It's that little nasty hydrogen atom, you know, with one electron, right? And it wants two. And the oxygen atom got six, two in the first shell, you know, a few more on the outside, but not enough. It wants eight. Those two get together, and boom, you got water. It's amazing, isn't it? Okay, now looking at hydrogen atom, as we're looking at it, we talked about, remember, you have to have two electrons in the first orbit to complete. You know, hydrogen has one, so therefore it has two in oxygen. In the next level, you want to have eight, and then on and on and on, okay? It's all there. So the energy between the first shell, the rotating shell of electrons, that energy shell, okay, we call that, you know, it's just give it the first ring, the first energy field, okay? Shell, they call it shells in physics. And then we go to shell number two. We go to shell number three, you know, now we're out to about 64 electrons. And it gets denser. And, of course, as this density increases, the atomic weight gets more. And so we start getting lead, which is pretty damn heavy. And then you get into gold, which is heavier yet. And then uranium, which is even heavier yet, until it depletes itself and becomes lead because it gave off a lot of energy and therefore became lighter. But still pretty heavy. So anyhow, these are called quantum numbers. And when we look at quantum numbers, we assign them particle properties depending on how active their energy, how much energy is in the electron going around the proton. How much is there? You know? And so what happens is, when we start looking at these nuclei and putting these quantum numbers on them, suddenly we realize that these things are not just moving, but they're stopping. But remember, we're looking at them at the speed of light, and we're saying, oh, the rotational speed of the electrons is something just under the speed of light, sublight speed. And so physics got really trapped in that, because it trapped us in time. It trapped us in a space of time, which is not really cool. Oh, we put a lot of pressure on space and time. So what we did is we started creating magnetic fields. And out of these magnetic fields, we found that we could create electricity in slow field rotations. And as we rotated these fields faster, we could create higher forms of electricity, which then became radiatory or radiation energy, like radio waves and TV waves and et cetera. Now, it's well known that if you are in science and you have a North Pole magnet and you have a South Pole magnet and you put the two together, they just go bump. Well, they're making out. They're kissing. Whereas if you have two North Pole magnets and try to push them together, if it's some of this new ceramic magnet material, they really push away very hard. Well, it's that pushing and pulling away of magnetic energy. If you attach wires to these magnets and keep them not touching physically, but only presenting their energies back and forth magnetically, the difference in potential is electricity, electrons moving through a wire. They're sucked in when the thing is pulling. The magnetic field is saying, oh, north, south, I want you. It sucks the energy right into the wire, that magnet. So cute, because you got the wire coming out of the magnet. The magnet's not touching the other magnet, and the electrons are heading right for it. And then you have two north poles or two south poles. Like poles, well, boom, they go the other way. Electrons run for the hills. Okay. So what we do is we measure that energy between the electron shells, and what we end up with are quantum magnetic numbers. Okay. Then we start looking at the shape of the orbiting electron around the proton. They all have shape, and I've described it as P orbitals, W orbitals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now what happens is that when we start dealing with time travel, okay, we start doing one little thing different. Imagine two perfect north and south pole horseshoe magnets, so you know the shape of them. On a horseshoe magnet, one end of the shoe is, one end of the U part of it is the north and one is the south. Okay? So now what I do is I take two horseshoes, two of them, and I push these two magnets. So if they were together, they would almost form a kind of like a racetrack shape. You cut a racetrack, elliptical racetrack in half, like a Hollywood bowl, you have two horseshoes, right? So look at it that way. So if I have two separate magnets, and I have them north to north, south to south, those two horseshoes, if you had two horseshoes on the ground, they're pushing away from each other. Now I switch one horseshoe over, okay, and now we have a north to south, south to pole, and now the horseshoes attract. But in the process of switching the horseshoes over, where they repelled to the attract, if you look at that magnetic, if you just could imagine a field of energy that you could paint green, and it's a shimmering green between these two magnets. As you turn the magnets over, keeping them still in a very close proximity of one another, keeping them on plane, rotating them exactly on their planes, meaning the center of the magnet is the pivoting point. So even though they can turn, they're always going to line up perfectly, whether it's against or each other, pulling or repulsing. Okay? That should paint the picture. In the process of the energy turning over, it creates what's called a Mobius field. Okay? The Mobius field is where the energy goes from attraction, repulsion, to the opposite. Total attraction or total repulsion. Nothing in between. That's a Mobius field. Then, when you combine a Mobius field with a scalar wave, the Mobius field is the atom twister, and the scalar wave is the time locator. That's all you need. The rest is easy. Now, think about that. Think about that. In all of creation, repulsing and attraction creates karma. I hate you, I love you. You're our allies, you're our enemies. It's all through history. Look at it. And when you look at it, you see the pattern. And you identify it as history. And what is the key element for that identification? It's time. Time has allowed you to see how the energy of magnetism works over time. Okay? Time is a scalar wave. That's the kind of stuff we play with in time machines. That's how it works. It's not all that complicated. Any theoretical physicist with any form of belief system could get it. He might have to do a little work on scalar waves, but then all you got to realize from that is energy follows thought. What a great way to open our program. Total confusion. I absolutely love it. When you start looking at scalar waves, I also, on page 382, I had to quote a little bit of Tesla, because he worked a lot in this. And I'm just going to read something here right out of the book. Remember, as we discussed earlier, a scalar wave is in itself timeless, but is a vehicle for time. Think about that. It's timeless, and it's a vehicle for time. Doesn't that just, like, take you there? It does me all the time. Because it is also of mind, remember, all reality is made of linked thoughts of mind. It can be controlled by mind. It originates in present mind and can be directed in past, present, and future directions. However, if we direct it towards the future, we need an additional ingredient, acceleration. So that matter being transposed can enter multiples of the fourth dimension. Because the scalar wave is composed of energy, including that of mind, it has a mass and will respond to the principles of acceleration, which is E equals MC squared. Now, when you start to move forward, now, in the time transposer, which is in the book, I'm not going there right now. I've skipped over it. That shows you how a machine could generate fields into your electron structure of all the cells and DNA of your body. Because any time in any technology that I have ever seen, and I've seen a few, and I'm sure there's many I haven't seen, probably proportionally far more than what I have seen, but I have seen this. In space and time, there are certain variables that just never change, regardless of the output of the ship's generators. And time is the most important part. And you're always in the now. For example, the future. There is no future. When I built the T1 time transposer, the first thing I tried to do is to go into the future. Don't we all? And using a technology, which maybe at a later date I'll go into the intimacy of it, but basically what we're doing is we're playing around with the electrons that are rotating around the atoms in your body. And suddenly what we're doing is, you know, we talked about it in earlier shows. You can go back in the archives, and we talked about the dance when they stopped. And they started vibrating, all these different energy planes then connected upstream. So we had the leptons and, you know, the omegaons, which are color from the astral plane, which allows you to perceive color, and the leptons is your gravity or your attraction, repulsion, all these different things. We've discussed all that in previous shows. But the bottom line is what we're doing in time travel is we're controlling those things at a prescribed amount of control. And on the ship, on the T1, you'll see these different capacitor plates. They're all around. They're above you. You're sitting in the middle of an octahedron, and these things looks like it's got a round shell on the outside because it has to move. Because if you travel backwards in time, which is no problem, and you end up inside of a mountain, you know, the mountain might have changed, and now where you were sitting on the surface of the mountain now might become... You might be stuck in the mountain somewhere and ruin the whole deal. The whole ship might be crushed. So you have to have mobility. So when you go backwards in time, the ship was not designed to go into space, but it's designed to go in time. And it's able to lift off the ground in the principles I've described in previous shows and hover some distance above the actual surface of the Earth while it goes backwards in time. Because time, you got to look at time as a, I always used to describe time to people, as a comet. The present is at the front of the comet, at the very front. And the past, obviously, is the tail. And the course of the comet is the future. Now, comets are normally depicted as having a path, like the Hale-Bopp comet, Halley's comet. They all have a path. And as they cross around our solar system, it gives a elliptical time pattern of that path. Time doesn't quite work that way. And remember also that a comet is traveling in a medium that's discernible, but it's also a principle. How could a comet do what a comet does if it wasn't a macrocosmic representation of a microcosmic event that would occur, obviously, in all space and all of time, in all holographs, which then means it's obviously very latently, probably hiding in plain sight in your DNA. So what we do, as with a T1 time transposer, is we tune the individual machine to your DNA. It's kind of a solo device, the way we design it. We could do multiple, but you'll have better results by yourself. And that's the way it was designed. And what it does is, as the two central wheels, there's two wheels in the middle of it. One goes to the right and one goes to the left. And I think if you remember when I described Semyasi's spaceship, the anti-grav, I think it was two shows back, the anti-grav system that is described there, where I'm using a magnetic and non-magnetic metal substance enclosed in something like glycerin, and then I'm pumping it against each other in a round circle, so one magnetic thing goes clockwise and a non-magnetic thing goes counterclockwise, and I'm squeezing it with these coils that we described last week, which are called Caduceus coils. You got all that going. You know, it's kind of like an orchestration. And with that orchestration, we put that in the time machine in a different manner. We don't make it as sophisticated as that. We just make a simple, what we call Wimhurst machine. And what it is in the disks that rotate around each other, and they're in the center of the ship. They have these metal plates on them. And the metal plate has a tendency to take all the electrons off the top of the, because it's wired to the top of the ship machine, and deposit them on the bottom, which leaves a void at the top. So these plates want to balance themselves because all their electrons have been stripped. This is over on page 392. You'll see a bunch of these pictures. And these fields create these linear field charges, which are set in resonance. Then through a proximity switch, we take the two opposite, the two rings that are spinning physically against each other, and we actually rotate the field changes, the charges right on the ring. Each segment of the ring has a field charge. We switch the field charge, and boom, we create a Mobius field. Because if you were holding two horseshoes together, what you're effectively doing is not only are you turning them over, but you're turning them inside out. And obviously, doing that with two horseshoes, it would be a little bit hard to do, but using that principle in another form, it makes it possible to make that change happen. And that's what we call the quantum mechanics side of it. And I think that's something that everybody should be looking at and studying. Now, going back to page 382, I have talked about this on my show with Dr. Deagle a couple times, and we talked about the scalar wave as on the negative side of it. And I'm just going to share a little bit more here. The scalar wave can be viewed as a reflection in the mirror, past, and the object being reflected, the present, and where the object could be reflected, the future. Now, as soon as you reflect to the future, and this goes to my second experience in the time machine, where I was, you got to imagine this thing is like 20 feet tall, and I could look out over a fence behind the enclosure it was stored behind and see cars on the road, you know, small street cars. And the second experience, when I was going forward in time, I could see the cars, a car coming up a hill, and I could see a beam of light coming out and hitting the pavement ahead of it, obviously because it's on a hill. So it would be the angle of attack would be intense, and the pavement level would be low. So it's hitting that. And as it hits that, instead of seeing a beam of light, I'm seeing a bunch of spots. I'm seeing complete blackness, void, and then I'm seeing little spots of light little like sand spots moving. Because I was moving in time and space just slightly ahead of that phenomenon of the car going up the hill. The car didn't even appear to be moving. Just so you know, it was probably moving at 30 miles an hour, but when things are sped up to this level, it would appear motionless. And looking at it at this level, how far ahead of time was I? That's what people used to ask me. Well, I was so far ahead that probably 100 millionth of a second was about how far ahead I was. In other words, by normal human faculty discernible observations and feelings, I hadn't gone anywhere in time. But all I have to do was go millionth of a second. This is a speed of light, 186,273 miles per second. All I had to do was to go 100 millionth of a second out of this illusion that everything's locked in that we've been talking about, and that's what I was able to do. Meaning that the machine was damn crude, barely functionable, but it worked. And that was the cool thing. It actually worked. I had the experience. So, that cemented, you know, an idea, which Sannyasi had always helped. She helped me. It was really funny because the time machine was, the outer ring was 12 feet across. And when I was building it, Sannyasi says, build it at 10 feet across. And I said, I could do that, but let's just build a little bit bigger. There's more room in it. She says, you'll be sorry. And I was. Because by building it 2 extra feet, it almost made the size a third bigger. So, being a third bigger, it stood out in my backyard in Laguna Beach, which has very strict building codes, and it wasn't long before, even sitting behind a fence, people noticed this huge structure going up. It was almost the size of my house in the backyard. And I had to do politics down here for four different mayors. I kept that thing back there for 16 years, and a term of a mayor here is 4 years. So, it was interesting. I had a lot of mayors at my house, mayors of the city. I guess it was my first entry into politics on a serious level. Who knows? Over a damn time machine. They got a kick out of it. One of them actually believed in it. Now, here's the next part. The scalar wave shown is of its simplest nature. Now, this is on page 383 in the book, and it looks like two trapezoids, except I've got some drawings and things on the inside. When combined with, for example, a strong neutron source modulated in the Mobius electron field, it becomes a death ray, as described by Nikola Tesla. Okay, now let me just take you a little bit into this area so you understand that how this could exist. Bob Lazar, when he was out at Area 51, described an element, a heavy element, a little bit heavier than the last element, known as 115. The silvery metal, a lot like U-238. And when you hit it with a slow neutron, it created what we call gravity waves. Gravity waves? Hello. That's like imagine a big steel pole getting slammed with a cannonball and creating a block wall field that we talked about in the last two sessions, which is also in the book. And that's where you split the magnetism and the energy, and you actually create a Mobius field within the magnetism itself by shock. You know, by shock. The cannonball hitting it, this neutron hitting this heavy element. This element has got a lot going on, and it's very stressed out. It wants to blow up at any time, and so what keeps it from blowing up, it generates gravity waves. Same thing happens when a star, like our star, a G4, some stars get to be much older, a billion years older, and they start to run out of hydrogen fuel, so they start to shrink. They cool down in an absolute space where it's cold. They're the sustainers of heat. It cools down, and it creates a huge gravity around them. Maybe you might have weighed, if you could have lived on a fire star, you'd weigh a couple of pounds, and then when it collapsed, you raised a couple thousand pounds. And this is what happened. And so that creates an event horizon. An event horizon, all things in the universe get sucked into them. It creates what they call a black hole and a space-time singularity. So what we're doing here is we're looking at that principle. That's a macro principle. But if you take a little old glass, like Ella Fitzgerald used to do when she was selling 3M tape, and just sing a little bit, it doesn't take much energy out of her vocals, boom, there goes the glass. It's just melted into oblivion, and there's pieces of it all over the room. It's the same thing. That is exactly the resonating source that lights up a star. It lights up your ATP in your body. And when you get in touch with that principle, what happens is you're in touch with life itself. And the extraterrestrial races are. So, now looking at the bad side of it, we're showing a scalar wave here, and what I say in the book is when the scalar wave shown is of the simplest nature. When combined with, for example, a strong neutron modulated in a Mobius electron field, it becomes a death ray, as described by Nikola Tesla. Now, remember earlier, you're going to have to do your homework and play this tape or whatever you're listening to it on over to remember how I'm describing the Mobius field, the horseshoe, magnets, the twisting, the suddenly turning inside out, twisting. You know, the best way to describe the Mobius effect is that for a moment, instead of just turning and facing each other, the bottoms of the horseshoes are still facing each other. For a moment, while they're in a horizontal position, for example, they flipped over and faced away from each other and repeated the full ritual with the U-shape touching against the U-shape, doing the full ritual of turning over 360 degrees, and then doing a 180 degrees between the two U-shapes and facing each other, and the field that would have generated, and you can actually manipulate horseshoes, magnetic horseshoes, to do that, isn't actually a Mobius field. That would work. So imagine that, and imagine that effect on that on your body. And all the electrons in your body, you know, you think a magnetic field doesn't affect them? You get enough Gauss going, it'll kill you. It's not a problem. We don't do that, but I mean, it's that it affects you, okay, big time. So anyway, I'll repeat this again. The scalar wave shown is the simplest nature. When combined with, for example, a strong neutron source modulated in a Mobius electron field, becomes a death ray, as described by Nikola Tesla. Each of the time zones, T1, right arrow, T4, etc., represents a controlling factor for time travel. It's exactly like in the irradiators when we talked about those, where we had seven of these devices in a 360-degree circle, and each one is 52 degrees apart, so therefore it forms a perfect angle of pi, the angle of a pyramid, 52 degrees, because that's the spacing, and you have a perfect circle. So you've got seven devices 52 degrees apart in a circle, okay? And they all generate a different energy, and the combined energy of a system three, when it's tuned right, we never talked about that, you can tune them up to do a Mobius. That's another kind of tuning. They generate a Mobius field. That's why we do the time travel. We did talk a little bit about the time travel, but not much. Anyway, each of the time zones, T1, right arrow, T4, represent a controlling factor for time travel. If the time gradient is directed into the fourth dimension momentarily and then back to the present, back out to the present, we have now created a ray that will disassemble matter in the present. Okay, now let me just repeat that. It's very simple. These time zones, we've described this tonight, how we do the horseshoe magnets. Okay, and if we do each one of these, if each one of these gradients, meaning each one of the T7s, T1, T2, is directed in the fourth dimension momentarily, and then back out of the present. In other words, don't leave it there. Bring it out. What happens is it causes a dismantling of matter, because the matter, which is created, it's an attraction. It's like gravity, and matter is when things attract to themselves what they are. That's matter, and gravity does that. When you start disrupting that, what do you got? You have an energy that makes things not be able to be attached anymore. You've taken away the internal gravity. The internal gravity, things that make us attract. You know, your hand, if you look at your hand, it's attracted to itself. There's bones, you know, there's blood, there's fat, there's muscle, and there's skin. And a few, you know, organs in there to support toxins in there, sweat glands, etc. Okay? They all attract. There's little fields going on there in the cells. Each little cell is just attracting, repulsing, and just working away. And the character of that determines the length of the DNA, and this is how your hand is what it is. But if you tell that field that it doesn't agree with itself in time, boom, it's gone. And that's the death ray. Now, I won't go on anymore, but in the death ray mode, the ray would always emerge after T2 and before T3 and T4. They would never exist. And because of that, I just can't go any further. But I think there's enough there for you to get the idea of how it works. Because I, to be honest with you, I've heard all these death ray explanations in the world, other than what Sannyasi explained to me, which was this one. Well, I didn't create this explanation. She did. I never got one that made any sense. This made sense, because I do have a background in physics. Probably that's the only way it made sense. Well, I'm glad we're having fun tonight. Now, to get a visual idea, imagine the Möbius field being created with the physical atomic structure of the object to be moved in time. As the Möbius field reaches its peak intensity, now, where would that be? Where would that be? Peak intensity. That would be about the time that we had the two magnets back to back. And they're back to back, so their polarities are pushing and pulling polarities, have the least effect on the magnets. But as soon as we swivel them 180 degrees on their other axis, their vertical, their center axis, center of the horseshoe, looking at it with, if you were holding it in your hand, trying to balance it, that's the center, and flipping it over the other way, where the two ends are going to attract or repel, depending on if they're going to the left or the right. So that part before it all begins is the peak energy of the Möbius field. Time likes the least resistance of energy. Time exists in waves of resistance and non-resistance of energy. That is time. Just think about that. In the resistance of energy, I mean, put yourself into a non-existent point of view. Call that your hand, and take a toothpick and start stabbing, you're pushing that against your hand. The toothpick is reality. Form, it's matter, and the time is just the fact that you're pushing your hand. But time, without time, you can't have matter, and vice versa. So, now I'll repeat that. Now, to get a visual idea, imagine the Möbius field being created when the physical atomic structure of the object has to be moved in time. So that toothpick is hitting your hand. I realize your hand is not a hand. It's only time. You're only able to sense or perceive that your hand is there. You don't see it as having five fingers, or if you're an alien, six or whatever. You don't see it that way. It's just there, and you can feel it. If you stuck it in a fan, you know, or something, you'd feel that. Or if you put an ice cube in it, you'd feel that. But the idea is not to feel anything. You know that that's a perceptive device. It's an idea of perception now, where we're using it in this diagram. And when the toothpick hits the hand from the back or the front, there's a feeling. The feeling is an event horizon, okay? Event horizon. Remember those event horizons. And for a later discussion, because we're going to run out of time here in a minute, we would call it a magnetic moment. And magnetic moments are very important. But before we get to magnetic moments, we got to understand that our hand is time. Until we feel anything, time doesn't matter. But as soon as feeling meets time, then form exists, obviously, and consciousness perceives itself, and we move on into identity features where we are now. But that's looking at on a very basic level. So as the Möbius field reaches its peak intensity, the electron clouds, orbital patterns, are then subjected to time orientation by the scalar component as it is injected with electrons, protons, neutrons, etc. of the structure. Then the structure is collapsed on a molecular level and moved into the fourth dimension window. From that window, it exists into the time reality thus programmed. And I just made this little snot remark. If you review chapter 35, you'll get a visual picture of the way the carbon atom behaves during this process. Okay, now what I have really described is the process of creation in a very simple way. A lot of people would have called this, well, maybe, you know, if you look at it right, that hand, that's God, right? They create, they call that God. It's really you. They call it God. And that pencil or that sharpened something hitting the front or back of your hand, remember, time is there, it's your hand. You wiggle your hand, you don't feel it until the pencil hits it, and then you feel it really good. Pencil is form matter, okay? So the abstract of the pencil of events, because they're now events, hitting time, it creates the events, is a scalar. It starts with, you know, the more you punch yourself with the pencil, time feels itself being punched because it didn't feel anything before. Now it has a feeling. Those feelings grow into worlds and man and the universe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's sort of how it works. And when you start realizing that, now I don't say hearing my words or understanding them, challenge it. I go to your best lamaseries in the world, go to your best science centers, just challenge what I say. I love it. I love a challenge. Oh, and also at this point, I wanted to bring up, I got some emails and great emails, and I guess I was being compared to Seth and a bunch of other people, and the emails were very complimentary. They said, oh, well, Seth says this, and blah, blah, blah says this. And truth is the truth. I didn't read Seth. I've never read anybody. I've never had time because I got such a huge ego. I can only write my own ideas. But I did spend 20-some years with the Pleiadians. And before that, I had a very good solid 30 years of solid training by the best in our government, in the best universities. I spent 8 years lecturing in all the big universities all around the country as a lecturer, coming as a guest speaker, doing science. I was offered, Bucky Fuller, where were you? Amherst College. A huge grant to move back there. And it was a great, great compliment to be offered that by Mr. Fuller. And it was, I'd issued a challenge to him on his campus. That was Amherst College in Massachusetts. I got pictures of me doing the radio show back then. Hey, another radio show. I did Amherst. Yeah, that was cool. For a couple of days. They gave me a great plaque for that. Hope BBS Radio gives me a plaque for that. And, it was a great honor. And I challenged Buckminster Fuller over the carbon atom. We had a challenge out. I was doing a seminar there on the weekend, and when I issued the challenge, his professors now, and a professorship in a university that's Ivy League is a big deal. And I had about, 10 or 12 of them challenge me on what Buckminster Fuller had said about the constitutionality of the carbon atom. It was so funny. I said, Buckminster Fuller is wrong. And I'm in his school. I never met the man. And this is on a Saturday. So I says, here's where he's wrong. And I'm on a blackboard, and I get up there and do the atomic mass diagrams for Bucky, and or actually his professor. Oh, God, that was a great story. If I ever get VBS Radio to post some more of my stuff, I got this whole story, all in photographs. I've got all of it. It's all beautiful. I have a beautiful library of these photographs where this happened. And all going down. But bottom line was, Saturday was a wipeout because it was about a seven, eight-hour class I was giving back there to the professors and some of the students, the advanced ones. And I challenged pretty much half of what Buck Fuller was all about. And these guys didn't know what to do. And I wouldn't back down. So we dismissed. And Sunday we started in the early afternoon. And they came back, with about 15 of them, professors. And they had talked to Buckminster Fuller on Saturday night, obviously. It was so great. And, you know, I got to understand, I was wild and loose and fancy free with my ideas. I didn't care what anybody believed me. I knew I was right. I had a great teacher behind me, and I had a good understanding. I've been doing it since I was 14. Buckminster Fuller surrendered to my ideas. His idea, what he told the faculty was, that listen to Dr. Fred Bell. That Fred Bell probably has ideas, and he's standing on my shoulders presenting the next few. And the funny part about it was I had presented that to them, that philosophy, the day before, saying, well, maybe I'm standing on his shoulders and I can see a little higher into the universe than he can, and you might just think about that. And don't realize that I'm the top of the heap. Somebody one day will stand on my shoulders and see a lot more than I did. And I says, that's evolution. Now I actually told them, go put that in your pipe and smoke it. That really got them. Well, they smoked a lot of pot back there anyway, so... They went back to Bug Fuller. He agreed with them. That afternoon, I finished my class. There was no argument. They just wanted questions all afternoon from the staff. And this is a, Amherst, by the way, is a pre-med school for Harvard. So anyway, but they do a lot of, they're pre-med, and they're also pre-science for John Hopkins. So, I mean, a lot of stuff. But anyway, it was really fun because at the end of the day, at about 5 o'clock, they took me to dinner, a whole new attitude. Saturday, I was a piece of shit, excuse the vernacular, but I was. And they take me to dinner and they say, on behalf of Buckminster Fuller and blah, 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 we would be offered, would you come out here and spend one semester, was a quarter of a year, a $50,000 grant to work on your theoretical physics of the Mobius pattern and the carbon atom and all the stuff that I'm talking to you about tonight. And this is like 78? Hello. And it was a great honor. It was a great honor. It was probably one of the greatest honors of my life to have been offered that. That was a dream come true, and I had to decline it because I did it with comedic way. I told him, I said, I used to live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I don't like shoveling snow. They all laugh. And I said, but and seriously, I have this company, Paradigm. It's a fledgling company. Paradigm was only started in 74, actually 75. And it's a fledgling company. It's my life stream. I've got to go do this. And I love Buckminster Fuller. And I've been welcome there ever since in a lot of schools. That was the great old days. And, of course, Bucky passed on. And some of those people, they still correspond to me. And it's been a great time. I really like... you know, this theoretical stuff I do. I've got if I start building the X1 healing machine, I have a standing offer from the royal family in Japan to go into Sony. Sony is very interested in my work. I just haven't had the time or the money because I'm running a company that, you know, it takes a certain amount of time to, you know, bring all this stuff out to the world, which we're doing, and make it available. But on the other hand, Sony wanted to come over and they wanted to work on the transmitting tubes in the T1 healing machine. The X1 healing machine, I'm sorry. So it'll be interesting if we get over to Sony. And I also have several other universities around the world and companies that are begging me even as we speak to go out and do projects with them. But I don't know what's wrong with me, but I just have to stay here with the people, the heartbeat. These projects would take me out of this. They want me back like NASA. And speaking of that, which is a good way to kind of bring this program to an end, it's been about 10 years now. I used to say 5, but it's been about 10 years. And about 10 years ago, I was up in San Francisco doing a health show. And I was really enjoying it. And when you know it, it, a couple of guys from NASA Moffett Field up there in the Bay Area, down there by San Jose, said, Fred Bell, we want you to, would you do a little project? We've been studying your work. Yeah, of course they study my work. And would you, we have this project, it's got a $50,000 grant, same amount as the other one I was offered, strangely enough. And they said, well, would you take this project down? We want jet airliners to get better gas mileage. That was the bottom line. And I said, okay, not a problem. What do you want? Show us how to take a 737 and get 15% more fuel efficiency. I says, okay. This is the kind of stuff. I mean, it sounds a little strange. This is the kind of stuff I do, you know. And I said, okay, I can do that. I'll get you some. And I actually sat down, and I did. I took the, it's on page 436. There's the 737. God bless that airplane. I love it. My friend is, another story, another time, is how we had a problem with the rudder on that thing, which made him flip over. And my friend, one of my colonel friends out in Texas, fixed it. We'll talk about that. But anyway, as NASA aims, they give me a small research grant. What I did is I saw right away, I envisioned to insulate the forward surface of the aircraft with a positively charged magnetic dielectric and a negative charged dielectric across the trailing edges. So what I was doing is I said, well, you know, if you're flying an airplane or driving a car or even running or riding a bike, you're pushing wind. So wind is a resistance, air pressure. So what is air? Let's look at air electrically. Air electrically is positrons, positive electrons, mostly. And that creates a positive ion when it's in motion. Okay? But if you stop it, then what happens is there's no friction. So what I did is I created across the front of the airplane, I took all the positive charges and I delivered them to the back. So the more positive that you put on the front of the airplane, I put a negative charge on the trailing edge. And that was, it was so simple. So the harder you pushed against it, the greater it attracted. So the air started attracting itself across the surface, giving more lift. And you needed an electrical source to do this. I said, well, what's a great electrical source? Well, if you have a stream, right, and there's water, and you put a water wheel in it, and on the water wheel, you put a shaft in the center of it, and you put a north and south pole magnet on that shaft, and then you have that rotate inside of a coil, not a Caduceus coil, just a regular coil, a toroidal coil. Every time the north, south, and south pole go across the top of that coil, it's going to create electricity in two directions, positive and negative. So all you got to do is rectify that and shove it out the front, put it out the back, positive front, negative back, make it just eat itself alive. And that's what I did. I designed that. And so for my source of electricity, I just took the fire out of the jet engine. The heat. There's tremendous heat. Heat is just like current, and then it's cold outside. So I had electrodes in the hottest part, and electrodes connected, obviously, outside the tailpipe where there's no temperature. And I created the perfect dielectric between two charges you could ever create. And I hooked it to the wings and the tail, and the top of the tail and the back of the tail. And I called the engine thing a flame jet generator. Well, that really freaked out. That's on page 437. That really freaked out NASA. I got a big, big response. I had no idea why I was getting such a big, big response. And then they said, oh, Fred Bell. You know, they never called me Donnie. Fred Bell. We don't want anything that technical, that sophisticated. We're only giving a $50,000 grant. Can you come up with another design that's a little less sophisticated than that, please? About a week later, this got publicized around the network, you know, because in these days, I was hanging out with my buddies that worked on the Aurora. Deagle and I talked about that.
And so, if you look at page 440, Aviation News discovers that the B-2 bomber has exactly the system that I sent NASA for a 737 in Moffett Field at Ames Research. The same thing is in a B-2, allowing it to go supersonic. And if you remember in the Iraqi wars when the B-2s got there, they got there mighty quick.
Yeah.
I had publicized classified document, not even knowing it was classified, gotten resistance, embarrassment on the part of Ames, and embellishment from Aviation Weekly. So that's the kind of stuff, the trouble that I get into from time to time. I don't mind it, but yeah, it's life. So when I talk to you about these Mobius fields and all these other fields that I've been talking to you about, realize I'm not just pulling that out of a hat. This stuff is all real. It's not fantasy. It's not theory. Give us a call at 1-800-729-2603. Go to drfredbell.com. It takes you to Pyridine. It's going to be a really good seminar. A really good seminar. Dr. Deagle out here, we're going to rock and roll. And you know what? I think I actually wouldn't be surprised. I'm not going to predict it. I wouldn't be surprised. But daring, because the seminar, you got to understand where the seminar is. It's on, in this beautiful crater. Laguna Beach is built out of three big volcanoes. It's in this beautiful crater. It's like people think they're in Haleakala or somewhere, you know, Hawaii. I wouldn't be surprised this seminar and every concert I've ever played. I hope I get to play a concert at the seminar, because we've never ever played one without a ship. Well, anyway, my ride is here. Sorry I'm late, dear. She's going to throw me out in space without my spacesuit. These Pleiadians play hardball. Yes, dear. That's how I really was surrounded. She's the boss. Not about sex, about knowledge. She's got me under control. Because I'm a knowledge freak. Good night, all. You have listened to Dr. Fred Bell's Hell Science and Energy Show. Thanks. Mrs. Calabasas, wherever you are.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.
The most astounding book of our generation, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light by Dr. Fred Bell. Bring energy and healing technologies into your life that have been kept secret for centuries. Exposed or highly classified research projects in use today at NASA and Area 51. The book is available on Dr. Bell's website, www.pyradyne.com. You'll also see more information about Dr. Bell's nuclear receptors, which allow our bodies to process all forms of electromagnetic and chemical toxins, assuring longer, healthier life. Call 1-800-729-2603 today.
You're listening to BBS Radio, a blog and servcom production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.